From Iowa Public Radio News, I'm Ben Kiefer. This is The Exchange. This hour, we focus on the Fulbright. You've probably heard of it, but might not know much more about it. The Fulbright program is an international educational exchange program sponsored by the U.S. government. It's designed to increase mutual understanding between the people of the U.S. and other countries. This hour, we find out what it takes to become a Fulbright scholar and what opportunities the scholarship offers. We'll also talk with a couple of Fulbright scholars, Marisa Handler of the University of Iowa Writers Workshop and Sheila Lee of Grinnell College. Our discussion starts right after this news. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, and this hour we focus on the Fulbright. You've no doubt heard of it, but might not know much more about it. The Fulbright program is an international educational exchange program sponsored by the U.S. government, and it's designed to increase mutual understanding between the people of the U.S. and other countries. This hour we find out what it takes to become a Fulbright scholar and what opportunities the scholarship offers. But before we talk more in depth about the program, let's meet a brand new Fulbright scholar. Marisa Handler is a recent graduate of the prestigious University of Iowa Writers Workshop. She left behind the daily grind to travel the world for 6 years, telling stories of social and political activism that often go untold. And she's the author of a memoir titled Loyal to the Sky, Notes from an Activist, which received a 2008 Nautilus Award for world-changing books. Marisa Handler joins us this afternoon by phone. Good afternoon, Marisa.
Good afternoon, Ben. Thank you for having me on the show.
It's wonderful to have you. You grew up in South Africa. Is that lived in Cape Town until you were 11?
I did, yes. Yes, in apartheid South Africa. So a very unusual society, a very twisted society.
Are your parents South African?
They are. We're South African Jews, actually. So we go back several generations coming from Eastern Europe and Russia.
What instances or can you recount an instance that stands out from your childhood in apartheid South Africa?
Yeah, you know, I opened Loyal to the Sky, my memoir, with an account of being in fifth grade, and it was the national election, and having this sort of showdown with some of my friends. So I went to a public school in Kemp's Bay in Cape Town, and because it was apartheid South Africa, my public school was all white. So the blacks were actually forcibly relegated out of city bounds into townships and homelands. So South Africa's black population lived just outside the cities, and then actually came in to work in households, etc. And so it was election time, and the party in South Africa that governed for many years, that constructed apartheid, was the National Party. And most of my friends' parents were voting for the National Party. And, you know, one of the girls was kind of ringleading this discussion of who's everybody's parents voting for. My parents were not voting for the National Party. They were voting for the Progressive Federal Party, which was the only legal alternative, really. This was also still a white party, but they advocated an end to apartheid. The African National Congress, the ANC, which, you know, waged a decades-long struggle against apartheid, was illegal, and so it was underground, so it wasn't actually included in the election. And so there's this face-down, which I narrate in Loyal to the Sky, where I'm confronted and I feel the need to be honest about the fact that my parents are voting for, you know, this other party, and that I think a black man or black woman could be president.
You say that in grade school.
I say that, yes. Happily for me, I was raised by parents who really opened our eyes to the fact that the society that we lived in was very twisted and wrong, and natural. And so I knew, and I had a good sense of that. I also, you know, just from the black people that I knew that worked in our household, I knew that there was no difference in intelligence. There was no difference, you know, the kinds of things that living in an apartheid state imbues the consciousness with, you know, which are horribly racist, but which my peers believed. You know, I knew these things were wrong, And when it came, you know, to a showdown, I felt the need to say, actually, no, I don't believe in this. And you know, this was a kind of an isolating thing on the playground.
Right, right. So that was you were from a different planet if you said that, I suppose, huh?
Kind of, yes, yes. And you know, I mean, in my little teeny social world, it was kind of devastating. But it, as I write in the book, it began a process of learning how to say no to what I believed and still believe is unjust. And and that, you know, in that first chapter, I talk a little bit about how when we choose to say no, when we choose to say I don't believe in this or I believe there's a better way, that very first step is often the hardest. And then once that step is taken, you know, there may be other hard junctures that we come to, but they get a little bit easier each time.
I believe after the age of 11, your family emigrated to Los Angeles. You went to the University of California, Berkeley, and got your undergraduate degree there, then spent a few years working for nonprofit organizations. It was then in the fall of 2001, you found yourself on a plane to Nepal and India. Why did you choose this?
I think there was a part of me that was feeling unfulfilled. I wasn't quite sure how to translate my convictions into practice, really. And I'd had, as you mentioned, a number of jobs. Upon graduating from Berkeley, I was offered a job doing management consulting with a prestigious firm, and it was, you know, they didn't make many job offers, and I was very lucky to get one, and I decided to turn it down and take a different path and devote myself to my creative pursuits and to my ideals of service, really, of helping. And then, you know, just didn't feel quite satisfied in any of the jobs that I did have, and just had this sense that there was something more, and that I needed to find it. And I think, you know, we live in a culture where we don't go through the kinds of rites that many other cultures, specifically, you know, still indigenous cultures, do go through, kind of rites of adulthood. And I think perhaps I was looking for something like that. And I felt the need to travel on my own. I felt the need to go somewhere about as different as I could imagine from what I knew. And for some reason, India was really calling to me. And so it didn't make much sense in many of the things they've done.
And in fact, I understand it was just weeks after 9/11 that you had this trip, planned to depart on this trip, and your family and friends urged you in a vehement way not to cancel the trip.
Right, right. I'd been planning it for a while, and then 9/11 happened, and of course people were worried because I was going to, you know, an area that wasn't very far from Afghanistan and from Pakistan, and I my mind and heart were set on it, so I said I'm going to go anyway. And I, one idea that I'd had, which I'd been working on and pitching for, was to, and I'd been freelancing a little bit as a journalist while in San Francisco, and then I thought, well, this is a particularly good time to be writing from that area, and pitched myself as a freelance stringer to the San Francisco Chronicle, and ended up writing a series of stories for them while I was traveling.
To deliver a perspective that became increasingly important, especially after 9/11, about tensions in this part of the world, India, Pakistan, things that have not left our headlines now since 9/11.
Yes, exactly. You know, because the U.S. began this war in Afghanistan at the time, it really strengthened ties between the U.S. and Pakistan. The U.S. was using Pakistan for air force bases and for all kinds of things. And the U.S. had historically had good relations with India as well, but India and Pakistan historically have had very tense relations since partition in 1948, since the two countries basically split. And Kashmir is the main focus of this, but India felt like Pakistan was supporting terrorism on Indian soil, and there was a lot of resentment. And so when the U.S. became closer to Pakistan, you know, this resentment only grew. And as during this time, there was actually more terrorism taking place in India, and India was blaming this on Pakistan and felt like the rest of the world, you know, especially the U.S., was ignoring mm-hmm. this because of the war in Afghanistan. And, you know, essentially things just worsened from there. The two countries, India and Pakistan, actually came really close to terrible war, to nuclear war in this time. And this was not getting reported on the U.S. because of course, most of the reporting in the U.S. was focusing on, you know, the consequences of 9/11 and the war in Afghanistan. But India had actually, meanwhile, marshaled half its army on the border with Pakistan, including nuclear-capable weapons. And thankfully, that didn't actually end up erupting. It, you know, things sort of simmered down. But what it did do, as it always does when there's political tensions between these countries, is it exacerbates ethnic tensions within India. And Hindu-Muslim relations in India are very charged,
mm-hmm.
Despite the fact that the majority of Muslims in India are moderate. There is still this little minority that is militant and radical, and you know there is still terrorism, and so it culminated in riots, and you know a number of Hindus were killed, and then 2,000 Muslims were actually slaughtered in Gujarat.
Marisa Handler, we have to take a short break in just a minute, and I wanted to continue our journey with you along your journey here. That you're a new Fulbright scholar. If our listeners just joined us, a new Fulbright scholar. Marisa Handler, and she's a recent graduate of the University of Iowa Writers Workshop. As we've got to take a short break, Marisa. I want to ask you, we'll pick up your story. Lots of things to talk about. Your work in Ecuador, Guatemala, your work at the University of Iowa Writers Workshop in fiction after working in journalism. But I wanted to have our listeners have us enjoy a little bit of your music. This is off a CD that you put out. This is a song called Relinquish. Tell us a little bit about it so that we can hear a little bit going into the break, and then we'll come back with you. Relinquished is the song. Tell us about this one.
It's a love song, and it's a song about letting go. And I like to think that all my songs on some level, whether they're dealing with you know, my personal relations or with social justice issues, are love songs, and this is a pretty personal one.
Okay, Fulbright scholar Marisa Handler with us. She'll be back after the break. This is her original music, her lovely voice. Relinquish, the title of this song. Back with The Exchange, I'm Ben Kiefer. Marisa Handler with us for our first half hour, a recent graduate of the prestigious University of Iowa Writers Workshop and one of the newest Fulbright scholars, talking about Fulbright scholarships, the program a little later in the hour, but this half hour, getting a profile of Marisa and her interesting work as a journalist, as an activist, as a fiction writer, as we'll find out here, as a musician. And so, Marisa, pick it up a little bit. This journey to India, Pakistan, kicked off a 6-year journey in which you combined journalism with your activism. It took you to Ecuador, to Guatemala, to Nepal. What's another instance that stands out for you along this journey you took over 6 years?
Well, one particularly memorable time, you know, I've been an activist in the global justice movement. I did a lot of anti-war activism during the Bush era and also working against free trade agreements and towards more just forms of economies and politics. And I visited a community called the Sarayaku in Ecuador's southern Amazon. And this is an extraordinary community. It's not very big. It's about 1,000 people. And unlike many other communities that have been dealing with oil exploitation and gas exploitation projects, the Sarayaku had managed to mount this entirely nonviolent resistance, a deeply principled nonviolent resistance to this company coming onto their land. And they had managed to succeed where so many others, you know, really have been trampled. I mean, these are, again, these are communities with, you know, from our viewpoint, nothing, you know, materially. They have very little money. And I went down there to visit them to see how it was that they were succeeding. At the time, you know, they had been working with lawyers. They'd been working with NGO allies all over the world. And their case had gone to the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights, and they had approved it. And ultimately, it actually ended up going to all the way up to the Inter-American Court on Human Rights, who ruled in their favor and against this oil company and against the government of Ecuador. So basically, they won their battle.
Mm.
And I went down there. I spent about a week and a half staying with them, you know, in this little remote part of the Amazon. It's not easy to get to. And interviewing people and just talking to them, and then I wrote a couple of stories on it. But the most remarkable thing, I spoke to one shaman in this community, and I said to him, you know, well, how do you feel about these oil workers? How do you feel about the CEO of this company? And, you know, at this point I've been active myself in a lot of campaigns. I've reported on a number of interesting campaigns and communities, and his response just really stood out to me. He said to me, Marisa, they live very far from real knowledge. That's what I believe, you know, and that's what he had to say about the CEO, for example, of this company. He didn't say, you know, I hate them, or they're evil, or they're trying to destroy us. He basically said to me, they're out of touch with wisdom.
Mm-hmm.
This is so fascinating.
Mm-hmm. Marisa, we have about 5 minutes left, and I wanted to get to another facet of your work. More recently, you were applied to and accepted at the University of Iowa Writers' Workshop into the fiction program. Now, after such a long time in journalism, were you somehow frustrated with journalism or just more interested in fiction and wanted to try that?
Well, when I wrote Loyal to the Sky, it ended up being a very creative project. It was a memoir, so I wrote from my own journals and from my journalism notes. But it took me in a direction of kind of showing the power of the stories and the kind of the behind-the-scenes stories of these people that I'd been writing about and of my own experiences. And I just wanted to keep exploring. I wanted to go further. I wanted to expand that creative space even more. And I felt that there was something that was calling me in that direction.
Mm-hmm.
Again, you know, from the surface level, whether it made rational sense is a question. I think I probably could have kept on publishing nonfiction books. But that was what drew me to apply to fiction programs.
Now soon, I think in a matter of weeks, you will return to India as a Fulbright scholar during the coming academic year. What are your plans at this point for your Fulbright year?
I'm going to be working on a novel in India. I'll be researching and writing. So I'll be in Varanasi, which is in the north. It's on the Ganges. It's a holy city. It's a place where Hindus, if they're devout enough and can afford to, they actually go to die there. They believe that if they die in Varanasi and circumstances are right, they can avoid the cycle of samsara, of reincarnation, and go straight to nirvana. So it's a very fascinating place, with a lot of energy, and it's where my novel is going to be set, at least about half of it. And I will be there. I'll be volunteering at a clinic while I'm there, and writing and reading and doing some other projects.
A health clinic you'll be working in?
Yes, it's a multi-level clinic, and I'll be working specifically with the rural poor that live on the outskirts of Varanasi.
Now, will you receive, as a Fulbright scholar, any training before this, or do they look at your resume and say, well, a very worldly person here, need not train, or will you?
No, we do have an orientation in D.C. in a couple of weeks, so they are giving us a little bit of training, and I imagine that the clinic that I'll be working at is actually it's a local NGO, so they, you know, they're based in Varanasi, and I imagine that they'll be giving me some of their own training.
So tell me, maybe you won't want to. I know many writers are hesitant about talking about works in progress. The novel, I believe, you started while here in Iowa at the workshop.
Yeah, I'd rather not get into it too much. It's still forming in my own, you know, mind and heart, but yes, I did begin it. I wrote a few chapters while here this past year.
Not set in Iowa. It's set in India.
It's not set in Iowa. It's set in India and in a fictional Northern California town.
Well, finally, can you tell us you're a young woman still, and any ideas where this interest in writing, activism, music, fiction will lead you later in life? Any definite long-term goals?
I have a lot of ideas. I always have a lot of ideas. So, I'm going to obviously continue writing. I know that I want to keep writing books. I sense that I will write both nonfiction and fiction over the course of the rest of my life. And that's primarily where my energy will probably be going. I also plan to keep singing and writing songs and performing. It's a really big part of who I am. And much of my activism has actually taken place through song. And in terms of social change and activism, that's also a large part of who I am, and I think that my energy will continue going there as well, but maybe from a slightly different perspective. I think some of the visioning work more so than the actual on-the-ground tactics and strategy.
Hmm. It's been fascinating hearing about your work and your life. Marisa, we want to wish you well in your further pursuits and make sure you touch bases with us when you're back in Iowa to keep us up to date on that.
Thanks so much, Ben. It's been a pleasure.
And hold on, please, because I want to have you tell us a little bit about a song of yours we'll be hearing going out. I want to remind our listeners that when we come back, we'll look at what it takes to become a Fulbright Scholar, what opportunities the scholarship offers. David Shug will be with us, a National and International Scholarships Program co-director at the University of Illinois. And we'll meet another Fulbright Scholar, Sheila Lee, a graduate of Grinnell College, when we come back. Right now, we're going to go into this break with some more music of Marisa Handler. This is the title track to your last CD, Loyal to the Sky. Any words about this in parting, Marisa?
Yeah, this song, actually, it's the title of my book, Loyal to the Sky, and it's a song on the album. It's a song that I wrote during the build-up to the war in Iraq, and I sang it, actually, on March 20th, 2003. March 19th, as you may recall, is when the war began in Iraq. And on March 20th, 20,000 people stepped out onto the streets of San Francisco in protest and effectively shut the city down, saying, if you're not going to listen to us because we're saying no to this war, then there are going to be actual consequences. And I was a tiny, tiny part of organizing that day, and I was working with an affinity group and with a larger cluster of people who occupied an intersection in downtown San Francisco and basically devoted it to art and music and poetry for the day. And so during that day, I got up at one point and sang this song.
Okay. Marisa, we'll have to leave it there. Leave a little time for your music. Marisa Handler, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Ben.
Journalist, activist, musician, and now Fulbright Scholar, Marisa Handler, our guest. When we come back, we'll talk more about the Fulbright, the program itself, and meet another Fulbright Scholar, a graduate of Grinnell College. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News.
I smell oil. I smell oil. I smell oil in the name of progress and liberty. Lies, oil-stained lies, make my blood boil. My blood boil. Is it too much to ask?
And we're back with The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. Thanks so much for joining us on this rainy noon hour today. Tomorrow on this program, make sure you tune in. We'll have a primary post-mortem. We'll do some analysis, talk to some of the winning candidates the day after the Iowa primaries. We'll look at the matchups and ask what issues are likely to be decisive as these campaigns gear up for the fall election tomorrow, Wednesday at noon. And remind you that tonight, some special primary coverage here on Iowa Public Radio's news stream on the hour. We'll have 5-minute updates at the top of the hour on the primary coverage as the returns come in, beginning at 8 p.m. this evening. Well, you've probably heard of it. If you've joined us the first half hour, you know we're talking about the Fulbright program, Fulbright Scholarships and International Educational exchange program sponsored by the United States government designed to increase mutual understanding between the people of the U.S. and other countries. And both Iowa State University, the University of Iowa, are on the list of top U.S. producers of Fulbright scholars for the 2009-2010 academic year. As it last half hour, we talked with Marisa Handler, one of the newest Fulbright scholars. 12 Iowans were awarded scholarships for the 2009-2010 academic year. A complete list of the 2010-2011 award winners has not yet been announced. We want to talk now further, more in depth about the program with David Shug, National and International Scholarships Program Co-Director at the University of Illinois in Champaign-Urbana. Since 2002, he has been working with top-notch students and alumni in preparing and applying for nationally competitive awards. David Shug, welcome to our program.
Thank you, Ben.
What qualities are sought after for a Fulbright scholar? What does a good candidate look like on paper?
Sure. They're looking for the student, of course, academic strength. Are you prepared to study? Do you have the academic background you need to complete the study that you've set out to do? Is your proposal what you're planning on doing in that country? Can it be done? Is it important? Oftentimes, you know, Fulbrights are all overseas. There needs to be some language qualifications. If you're planning on doing some in-depth interviews in Brazil, you better have a high level of Portuguese knowledge. But, you know, these scholarships, like you said, they're not just academic awards. They're looking for students who are you know, mature, motivated, are going to be able to not just handle living overseas for 9-10 months on a Fulbright grant, but they're actually going to be thriving there.
Mm-hmm.
They want students who know something about the host country. These applicants are going to be ambassadors for the U.S. while they're there. So knowing that they're going to be involved in the country, not just working on their project, but getting out and, you know, meeting people when they're going to the grocery store, and how are they going to interact as an American in a foreign country. Those things are all important.
So this is a quantum leap above your high school exchange student, of course, that you have a person who is has enough life experience and enough experience to propose a program, a project in one of these countries, and it's mostly, would you say, on that basis, the originality, the value of that project that the Fulbrights are chosen, in addition to their resume, their GPAs, and so forth?
Sure. I mean, usually the first question I ask a student when they're coming in for advising is, so why do you need to be in that country to do your project? Why do you need to be there that you can't conduct the same thing here in the United States? I think one of the most difficult parts about the Fulbright is just that and wonderful parts, is that it's so open to anyone planning to do practically anything anywhere in the world. You come up with a proposal, what would I like to learn about in this country, why do I need to be there, and then you talk in a two-page single-space essay, how am I going to spend my 9 months figuring out this thing that I'm planning to look at.
We want to reach out to our listeners now. Undoubtedly, we have some Fulbright scholars listening today. If you've been a Fulbright scholar, tell us your story. Perhaps you've lived and worked or studied abroad. We'd like to hear from you as well. How did it change your perspective, this work, study, abroad, your career plans? How did it shape your life? Tell us your story. 1-866-780-9100. 1-866-780-9100. Or email us, theexchange@iowapublicradio.org. Also joining us now, we have another Fulbright scholar. Sheila Lee is a native of Colorado and a graduate of Grinnell College. Sheila, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Great to have you join our program this afternoon. Now, you studied philosophy at Grinnell College, I understand.
And yes, I did.
Now you're into education. You spent your Fulbright year of scholarship where?
I spent it in Taiwan in 2008 to 2009. I was teaching English at a public urban elementary school in Kaohsiung, Taiwan, which is southern Taiwan.
Mm-hmm. How did you come to choose Taiwan? Had you had previous experience there?
I had never been to Taiwan, but I am of Chinese heritage. And I was always curious about my ethnicity and culture and the history that comes with being a Chinese American. And so when I was in college, I took Chinese classes, Mandarin courses, and really wanted to explore in depth the culture and just what it would be like to live in a country, in Taiwan specifically, because we didn't have English teaching assistantships in China.
Mm-hmm. Even though you have Chinese heritage, what was the biggest surprise in going and living in Taiwan?
Oh, well, the biggest, I guess, culture shock was all the scooters. I mean, that was the first immediate thing I noticed. But the next big thing that I noticed was the, since I was teaching English in Taiwan for my Fulbright project, I guess one of the largest things I noticed was how different the education system in Taiwan is from American school systems. Culture-wise, I was definitely shocked by how delicious the food was, how friendly the people were. I did have some setbacks where they didn't think I was American because I looked Chinese, and so I taught a lesson on diversity in America in the classroom, so it still turned out really well.
Okay, very good. Sheila, stay on the line. We'll come back to you in just a moment. We want to go to our callers, 1-866-780-9100, looking for those who perhaps have had a Fulbright scholarship, and Ron is joining us from Cedar Falls. Ron, you are a Fulbright scholar.
Yes.
Yeah, well, welcome to our program. You are a faculty member at the University of Northern Iowa?
Exactly.
And the Fulbright offers, we haven't mentioned this yet, a program for faculty members, don't they? Ron, are you there?
Yep.
Where did you go, Ron?
I was in Hungary
mm-hmm.
in the 2004-2005 academic year.
What was your project?
It was two parts, actually. I was working, trying to help them establish a conducting program in the School of Music at the university there, and to help them also understand the nature of American education in the sense of how credit hours are established. Why is this a 3-hour credit, and how does it come this is a 2-hour credit? And to help them to understand the American system as they were, because of the Bologna Agreement, we're moving in that direction.
Mm-hmm. When you returned to Iowa, how were you changed by this experience?
I would say the experience itself was just was so different from anything that we experienced here in this country. The culture is different. The food is different. The educational system is different. The people are different. Everything is quite different, and it forces one, whether you intend to or not, it forces one to look at the way we deal with the world differently. For instance, the language, the Hungarian is a difficult language to speak, and I always carried a little small dictionary around to help get through things, but I began to have an understanding of how people who cannot read or write must experience life, and it's quite difficult.
Mm.
Just move in a different tempo than we do here in America. Everything doesn't happen as we expect it. Sometimes the gas wouldn't work in my apartment. Sometimes the hot water heater wasn't working. And these kinds of things that we take for granted don't always happen in other countries.
Now, I understand it's been 4 or 5 years since you were on your Fulbright year. Do you keep up contact? Do you have some?
I do. Mm-hmm. At the conservatory there in Hungary, I keep in contact with several of the faculty members as well as the students. Who we were able to do several little projects that they've maintained in the conservatory there, and so it's been a great relationship.
Ron, thank you very much for telling us your story. Ron, a faculty member at the University of Northern Iowa, a recent Fulbright scholar. Thank you, Ron.
Thank you.
And Eve is joining us from Coralville, also a Fulbright fellow. You went where, Eve?
I was in Egypt. I was at the University of Cairo, and I was working in the veterinary school. And I think you'll find this rather interesting. I was studying the application of maggots to clean chronic infected wounds in donkeys.
Wow. And what did you discover? How can that, because maggots eat, yes, they eat flesh, right?
Well, the thing is, first of all, you have to have the correct species. Some species eat live tissue and some eat dead tissue. You want the ones that eat dead tissue. And what they do is they clean around an area and remove all the dead tissue. The reason we did it in Egypt was because even for veterinary, most people don't want to deal with maggots. We've spent 100 years learning how to keep them out of wounds.
Mm-hmm.
And now we're talking about reversing all that acquired wisdom.
Mm.
So you had to have somebody who was more open-minded toward the application of what is basically a creepy treatment.
Yeah, what do you feel you accomplished in your time in Egypt?
Well, I was there the last year before the Iraq war broke out. And so I had an opportunity to see what the attitude of just your average Egyptian was toward Americans, and also how the Americans acted in Egypt. In fact, there's always that stereotype of the Egyptians thinking a woman should be covered from head to foot. Well, when I was at the pyramids and I was dressed like an archaeologist, I was actually there to talk to them. I turned around, I watched the people getting off of a tour bus, and they had so very little clothing on that I thought they ought to be dressed.
As a Westerner, you thought, get some clothes on.
Oh, absolutely. These were not people who had anything that they really wanted to show off, but they seemed to think they looked great and skimpy. So I had to admit that when I was standing there with the camel herders, I thought the same thing they did. They really did look like they were out looking for action instead of out looking for archaeology.
Interesting. Eve, thank you for sharing that with us, and we'll definitely not go back to the maggots or any more in depth, especially during the noon hour. Eve, thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Eve from Coralville. David, Shug, there's a couple people, certainly a lot of people in our audience with the Fulbright experience.
Mm-hmm.
Very different experiences as we hear in these specifics.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, from the University of Illinois, for instance, we've had a student go to Denmark to study with like a glass-blowing master. We've had a student go to Peru to conduct bird surveys. A recipient is going to be heading off to Switzerland this year to neuroscience research. Somebody else is doing water purification in South Africa. I mean, the Fulbright really is. I mean, there's 1,700 grants available in the student program each year to more than 150 countries, and the wonder and amazement in being a Fulbright advisor is listening to all these students come up with all these wonderful topics that I otherwise wouldn't be hearing about that they'd like to go and study, and the State Department funds that under the Fulbright program.
Once you're a Fulbright scholar, I understand you're always a Fulbright scholar in that you talk about it throughout your life. Is there some kind of contract about that, a commitment to do that as well?
I know that Fulbright returnees all become part of the Fulbright Alumni Association, and they're automatically members, and they get newsletters, and right, they certainly are. They all become part of the same cohort. They've had similar experiences, and Fulbright. That's something that certainly the experience is going to be something that's going to stay with you for a long time. But the Fulbright name carries a lot, and that's going to be on your CV,
right,
your resume, whatever, throughout your lifetime.
Sheila Lee, native of Colorado, graduate of Grinnell College, still on the line with us, I hope, a Fulbright scholar from 2008 and 2009. Do you find that being able to put Fulbright on your resume has a lot of cachet, opens doors for you? I imagine so.
Yes, it has, and it was such a life-changing experience for me because I later went into education, and I'm now at Teachers College, Columbia University. And whenever I tell people about my Fulbright experience, I get so many questions about how it was, what it was like, and people I think recognize the mutual benefit it has for the United States and the host country, but they're very curious as to what my experience was like, and also I think it has opened a lot of new doors for me.
Mm-hmm. I understand you're pursuing a master's degree now, teaching students with disabilities in elementary education at Columbia University. Do you plan to go abroad again, perhaps back to Taiwan with your experience?
I was actually thinking of maybe trying mainland China the next time if I do go back, because I want to somehow integrate the language skills that I have developed from Taiwan and also the cultural awareness I've developed from Taiwan, and see how it differs in mainland China. I was hoping to actually work in special education in China maybe in the future, or somehow make use of the wonderful experience I had from Fulbright in the future. So,
mm-hmm. A few minutes left in our hour. Let's talk to Steve in Cedar Rapids. Steve, you were a Fulbright scholar?
Yes.
Where did you go?
I was in England in the city of Reading, and actually I was doing neutron scattering studies of GLESS.
Are you a faculty member or a student at that time?
I was a faculty member. I teach at Coe College in Cedar Rapids.
Mm-hmm. And so tell us more about the neutron scattering you were doing in England.
Well, if you take neutrons of the right speed and basically shoot them at a sample, in my case of glass, they will scatter at all sorts of angles, but they have certain patterns they form. And the patterns reflect how the atoms are arranged.
A glass
is a sort of a screwed up solid. It doesn't maintain order on a very large scale, but at the level of a couple of atoms, maybe, I don't know, 4 to 10 atoms, there's quite a bit of order, actually, and this technique can reveal that order.
What, are you a native of Iowa?
Well, as you can tell from my voice, I'm a native of Brooklyn, New York, but I've been in Iowa 31 years.
Okay, and what year did you go to England as a Fulbright?
1996. I was there for 7 months.
Mm-hmm. What would you say was the most valuable experience or way in which it affected you that year abroad?
Well, it affected me in opening up opportunities for my students. And for me, I've been back to England about 20 times since. And I do a lot of work not only at Reading, but also at the University of Warwick now. So it opened up a whole world of colleagues and opportunity for literally dozens of co-college students and myself.
Excellent. Steve, thank you for sharing your story. Steve from Cedar Rapids, a Fulbright scholar who went to England. Thank you, Steve.
Take care. Bye.
Bye-bye. Let's go to Lee in, is it Slater? Are you in Slater?
Yes. I'm a resident of Slater, Iowa, although I'm a faculty member at Minnesota State Mankato.
Mm-hmm. And you are a Fulbright scholar.
Yes, and I just returned a year ago. My host university was Beer Zeitz University on the West Bank. I lived in East Jerusalem for the spring semester 2009.
Mm-hmm. And what area of study are you focused on?
My field is technical communication. I had a research grant to research the online teaching that Beer Zeitz is, the online teaching projects that they're working on. I was with the Center for Continuing Education there at the university and wrote a paper with one of my colleagues there and have continued to work on that, on online teaching concepts mm-hmm. with them.
Having lived there, you must see our daily news and the problems in the Middle East with different eyes than most of us do.
Well, yes, I had actually lived in Jordan before that, and so it felt a little bit like going back to my second home, and I suppose I do read the news with a little different from a little different perspective. Yes.
Yes, Lee. Thank you very much for telling us about your experience. Returning Fulbright scholar Lee from Slater, Iowa. Thank you.
Thank you.
Just a few minutes left, David Shug. Tell us about the financial support that comes along with being a Fulbright scholar.
Sure. The Fulbright provides, it's basically a full ride for students going overseas. So they'll cover your airfare back and forth, all of your living expenses. Most countries have tuition waivers if you happen to be taking classes, all your insurance, medical. Basically, a student leaves with no money in their pocket and they come home with no money in their pocket. So it's a all-encompassing award. A great thing for especially recent graduates. I know a misperception. A lot of students think that the Fulbright is only for students doing like PhD research, but in fact, about 50% of the recipients are graduating seniors from universities. So they're really trying to target a younger population that does not really have yet extensive experience in the country where they're headed to.
Mm-hmm. And a considerable number of faculty, as we can hear from the feedback we've had.
Right,
this hour.
Yeah, there is a separate Fulbright faculty program as well. So certainly the recent graduates and the PhD students are not competing against faculty professors. They're in different tracks, of course.
I wonder if you can remind us some of the notable names, famous people, politicians, and otherwise that have been in the Fulbright program. I put you on the spot.
You put me on the spot with that one. I mean, I think all of our esteemed alumni Fulbright scholars are terrific people. I mean, the name Fulbright comes from, this was Senator Fulbright's baby, I guess. But you know, you can take a look in Congress, and No, I'm not good with remembering the names, but there's a number of leaders there who are Fulbright recipients, and that's all throughout. We just heard from numerous professors, faculty in Iowa, all campuses. There's going to be Fulbright scholars, and those are the leaders. Those are the international leaders on their campuses and in their discipline.
David Chug, I want to thank you for enlightening us and telling us more about a name that we recognize, have up to this point not known that much about. Many of us, in fact, not involved with the program. David Chug, National and International Scholarships Program Co-Director at the University of Illinois, Champaign-Urbana. Thank you very much.
You bet.
I want to thank also Sheila Lee, a graduate of Grinnell College, a Fulbright scholar. Sheila, if you're still on the line, thank you for joining us and sharing your experience.
Thank you.
And The Exchange is produced by Catherine Perkins and Lindsay Moon, with help from Jeff Schmidt and Alex Hoyer. Production assistance today from Christoph Mai. Technical support from Dennis Reese. Podcasting and on-demand audio of The Exchange. Perhaps you caught a few minutes of this hour and would like to hear the whole hour, go to iowapublicradio.org. There you'll find a podcast. You could also stream it online. We always welcome your comments and questions about this program. Contact us anytime, theexchange@iowapublicradio.org. And remember, tomorrow we'll do a primary post-mortem during the hour, some analysis, talk to some of the winning candidates the day after the Iowa primaries. Tonight, special primary coverage on the hour, a five-minute update beginning at 8 o'clock on the hour. Tune in for that. Our theme music was composed and performed by Dan Knight. The Exchange is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.